Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to start by introducing you to These Bloody Days, The Fall of Anne Boleyn. I'm thrilled to share that Dr. Owen Emerson and I have teamed up to bring you a week-long online event exploring Anne Boleyn's downfall, beginning on Monday, 13th of May, 2024. Through a series of 6 pre-recorded lectures and 1 live Zoom discussion, we'll delve deep into one of the most brutal and shocking events of Henry VIII's reign. We'll examine the courtship of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, the great matter and Anne's rise to the throne. We'll look at how Anne and Henry's relationship evolved once they were married and chart the main events of 1535 and 1536. We'll delve into the arrest, trial, and execution of an anointed queen and look at what took place in the aftermath of Anne's tragic fall. Participants will be entered into a special giveaway and have access to all recordings for 2 months after the event ends. Registrants will also get to spend part of the anniversary of Anne Boleyn's execution virtually with Owen and I. For lecture outlines and to reserve your place, just Google These Bloody Days, The Fall of Anne Boleyn, Eventbrite. I do hope you'll consider joining us. I'd also, of course, like to acknowledge and thank the wonderful listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon. And extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this really does mean a lot to me. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors Patreon family. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the Patreon family, you'll instantly unlock access to exclusive posts, including audio releases and videos. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. There are a number of designs and products available, including phone cases, mugs, notebooks, and apparel. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the podcast to talk about 4 extraordinary women writers from the 16th and 17th centuries is Professor Raimi Targoff. Raimi Targoff is Professor of English, Co-Chair of Italian Studies, and the Jehuda Reinhardt Director of the Mandel Center for the Humanities at Brandeis University. She holds a BA from Yale University and a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. Raimi is the author of numerous books on Renaissance poetry and religion and is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Raimi. How are you?
I'm fine. It's so nice to be here, Natalie. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I've been looking forward to our conversation. So let's maybe begin with you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about you and your background.
Sure. My name, as you said, is Raimi Targoff, and we're here to talk about my new book, Shakespeare's Sisters, How Women Wrote the Renaissance. And this is the 5th book I've written in my career as an English professor and professor of Renaissance literature. So my background is as a scholar of Shakespeare and the authors surrounding Shakespeare. In the last decade or so, I've become more and more focused on the mostly forgotten voices of the women who were living and actually writing at the time of Shakespeare. And so my research has shifted to thinking about who those women were and recovering them. I've been a professor for 27 years in an English department, and I also teach in Italian studies. So I have sort of 2 different fields. But that's how I've been spending my career.
And what a wonderful career. That sounds amazing. So we are here to talk about your new book, as you said. So Shakespeare's Sisters, Four Women Who Wrote the Renaissance. Do you want to tell us a little bit about maybe what inspired that project, the significance of the title, those sorts of things?
Sure, I'd love to. When I was an undergraduate at university, I graduated in 1989, so almost 35 years ago. I had never read a single word written by a woman before Jane Austen or Fanny Burney, you know, before the novelists from the period quite a bit later than the Renaissance. And so although my area of focus was on Renaissance literature, I had no idea there were women writing in the period. Part of that was because I had read, like many of us did in introductory women's studies classes or introduction to feminism, I had read Virginia Woolf's famous essay or short book, A Room of One's Own, in which she makes a very persuasive and passionate case for how impossible it would have been if Shakespeare had had a sister, and she calls her Judith, she invents this character, what would have happened to Judith if she'd had the same talent as her husband? And she goes on a long riff about poor Judith Shakespeare, who would have been treated like a witch. She would have gone insane. She might have ended her life with suicide because she was so lonely, so bereft. She would have had no opportunity. And I want to make clear, Virginia Woolf is right in many respects that being a woman writer in the Renaissance was unbelievably hard. But what she didn't know, and more or less couldn't have known because they'd been forgotten, was there were women who managed to do this, and women who managed to do this who weren't insane and weren't witches and lived reasonably happy lives and had families and husbands and were functioning, and not just functioning, were thriving. And the reason Virginia Woolf didn't know about them for the most part is because after their deaths, soon after deaths, they were forgotten. So my title is a gesture towards that group of people whom Virginia Woolf treats as an impossible category. And I've chosen four, as the subtitle says, four women who wrote the Renaissance. I've chosen four out of, I would say, seven or eight, at least six or seven, whom I could have chosen. In other words, there aren't 200 of these women at the level that I'm describing them. But there aren't just the four. I chose four women who wrote in different genres to give my readers a sampling of what women were doing. And also because these four women have interesting overlaps with one another. Several of them knew one another. And so I don't know if you've had a chance just to read the book, but the book is interwoven. So it keeps shifting characters, and it tries to show the ways in which there was a loose network of women writing at the time.
So before we talk a little bit about these amazing women that you feature in your book, can you tell us a little bit more about those challenges that you've mentioned and that Virginia Woolf clearly mentioned that women writers faced in the 16th and 17th centuries as well?
Yes, absolutely. So the first and maybe most relevant thing to say is that women did not go to school, period. There were very, very, very few opportunities for women to get any education. And to the extent that they had any opportunity, it would have been at the grammar school level, at the elementary school level. So, you know, middle-class men or boys could get all the way to university. Christopher Marlowe was the son of a shoemaker, and he managed to get to Cambridge on a scholarship. This is not to say that there was tremendous opportunity for lower class and middle class, it would have been middle class men, but even women of the highest social class had no chance of going to university. They had no chance of going to secondary school. So we're dealing with a population that is severely undereducated by its society. So that's the biggest thing we need to think about. And it's very hard, Natalie, to estimate literacy rates, because in fact, a lot of people could read but not write. Those are two different things, but we judge it by whether people can write. That's the only thing we have access to. So people who are illiterate usually sign their name with an X. However, taking that into consideration, historians have estimated that probably a maximum of 10% of women in London were illiterate, and lower outside of London. So we're talking again about a population that had very little access to education in a institutional way, and whose literacy was not encouraged or necessary. These women were not going on to have professional lives, so they didn't need to be literate. So how did these women the women I'm writing about, how did they get their education? At home. They got it at home. And so it really depended very much on the luck of the family you were born into, whether they valued educating their daughters, why that mattered to them, whether they had brothers, and therefore possibly there were tutors coming into the house at earlier ages, because boys, when they were young, were educated at home very often, aristocratic boys. I should also say that given everything we're describing, it's not a coincidence that two of the women, of my four women, were from the aristocratic class. One was what we would say sort of a wealthy bourgeois person. Her father was a successful lawyer. So even though they weren't titled, they had the means to educate their daughter. And then one of them actually, who was the most interesting in terms of class, was the daughter of an Italian immigrant who was a musician and therefore was not from a wealthy family. Her mother was illiterate. And it's quite extraordinary that she became the first woman to publish a book of poetry in the 17th century. So that's the sort of basic picture I could give you.
Yeah, so they were certainly up against a lot. That is quite amazing. So considering all those things that you've just spoken about, can you tell us a little bit about how women then navigated these constraints that were imposed on them?
Yes, it's really interesting to see in the case of each of these four women who wrote, as I said before, in very different genres and wrote very different kinds of things, how they managed to think they had even the right to be authors or to write their own works. I would say that in three of the four cases, actually, everyone except for Amelia Lanier, who was the woman I was just describing, who was the daughter of an immigrant, the other three women had parents who valued their daughter's education. And I think it's really interesting that two of them were only children. So I say that because, you know, had they had brilliant boys at home, maybe they would have thought less about their daughter's education. But both Anne Clifford had two brothers who died in either infancy or very young childhood, one before her birth and one after. But so she was, by the time she was one or one and a half, she was an only child. And Elizabeth Cary was an only child, period. So I think that's not a coincidence. You know, if you have one child and you're an educated family, you know, it's hard maybe not to educate that child. Mary Sidney's family came from a long line of educated women, actually. Her grandmother was at the court of Henry VIII and was well known for being very well versed in the Bible and was a sort of serious Protestant scholar for a woman. So she had a very educated grandmother, a very educated mother, and therefore I think it behooved the family to educate their daughters. And we do have records of different tutors coming in and out during the day for the different children. So while the boys were learning, you know, Latin and philosophy, the girls were studying French and music and so on. So there was a distribution. But all of this would have just been laying the grounds. We're talking now about education. And part of what's interesting about your question is, you know, how did they go from that to deciding that they could write works of their own? And that's a big leap. And that's the kind of thing that Virginia Woolf thinks is impossible. You know, it's very unclear if anyone encouraged them. In other words, we don't have signs of people saying, you should really write this up. You should, you know, so I mean, there are four different people and they have very different stories. But I would say what I came to feel studying and reading these women was that they had it in them. It was their vocation. And, you know, how is it that a 12-year-old girl starts to write? You know, we can all imagine that. Those of us who were 12-year-old girls, you know, it's not because someone told you to write. It's something that you feel you want to do within. I should also just add that there's lots of evidence that all of them were extraordinary readers. So I would have said reading came first. You know, they were voracious readers. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite anecdotes about Elizabeth Cary is that her mother, when she was a girl, took away all the candles so that she couldn't keep reading at night because she was afraid she was going to ruin her eyes. And Elizabeth Cary apparently bribed her servants to supply her with candles. And after she got married, she repaid them. We have evidence that she paid them back. So she was reading till all hours of the night. But I do think that reading was their education, basically.
I love that anecdote. You get a real sense of the personality, don't you? The person.
Yes, totally.
And we probably all know, like I was a primary school teacher for many years, so I can think of children, you know, that come to mind that were just voracious readers and incredible writers from such a young age. So, you know, we still sort of have it, don't we? So I need to hear more, Raimi, about these incredible women. So you've mentioned that there are four that you feature, and you've talked a little bit, you've given some of the names there, all of them, I think. So can we start with Mary Sidney? You've talked a little bit about her, but can you tell us a little bit more about her life and her work as well?
Sure. So Mary Sidney is someone who, on the surface of things, had the most privileged life. And I can say that about Anne Clifford also. You know, she was born into an aristocratic household. She had siblings, she had servants, she had tutors coming in and out. On the other hand, as a young woman, she experienced what I think all of us would agree was a total trauma, which was, you know, her beloved sister, who was a year older than her, died from an illness. The next thing she knows, she's being shipped off away from home. And home was primarily in Ludlow in Wales. She lived in Ludlow Castle. That was her father's. Her father was the governor of the Marches in Wales. So they lived in this extraordinary castle. She was shipped off to be a maid of honor at the court of Queen Elizabeth. Now, this was a great honor, as the title suggests. On the other hand, you know, she was a young girl. She wasn't quite 14. And she just lost her beloved sister. And she left home and made what would have been a significant journey from Wales to London to live at court. And within, you know, less than 2 years, she was being married off to a man who'd been married twice before, who was 23 years her elder. So she's 15 and he's 38. No sign that she's interested in him or attracted to him. No sign, by the way, that he's particularly interested in her, except that she comes from the right family and she's young. And his goal was to have an heir, which had eluded him until that point. So the two marriages had been childless. One was a very brief marriage, but in any case, he was the Earl of Pembroke. So he had an extraordinary fortune and estates and title that he needed to be passed on. So Mary Sidney is married off as a teenager to this much older man with whom she has no connection personally. And one of the most interesting ways that she expresses the pain of that or the sorrow of that is through her writing in the most subtle way, Natalie, because one of the things that she did that she's most famous for, in fact, was that she, and I'll come back to this maybe in a minute, but she translated the Psalms of David into magnificent English poetry. And the way you can tell that these Psalms were translated by a woman is there are these moments in the Bible that get just quickly skipped over that she brings to life. So just on the topic of her marriage, there's a moment when this young Egyptian princess is being taken away from her family to marry Solomon. And it's, as I say, it's no one emphasizes this except for Mary Sidney, but she talks about her homesickness, the princess's homesickness, and about being torn away from her parents. And so you hear the kind of anguish that she must have felt. Otherwise, it's very hard to get access to that because unlike Anne Clifford, who we'll get to, who kept a diary forever, we don't have access to Mary Sidney's inner life. So we learn about her more through her correspondences, but also through her writing. So in her case, although the circumstances I just described were very difficult and also by no means unusual. I mean, arranged marriage, all marriages were arranged unless you sort of ran off and got in trouble, especially among the nobility. It seems like the marriage was quite supportive in the sense that her husband allowed her to write and to create a library and to invite poets and friends over. Some people talk about her having a salon at Wilton, which is their principal estate near Salisbury. I'm not sure. There's not really a lot of evidence that it was what we would consider a salon, but she certainly brought tutors for her children who were well-known poets and historians, and she was a great patroness. But most of the writing that she did that has survived is translation. So she was a translator of the Psalms. She was a poet. She was a poet in terms of her craft. But She only wrote a few original poems that have survived. And then she did some extraordinary work as a translator.
It's amazing. It does seem that translating was, if women were going to write, that was sort of like an acceptable form of work for them, I think, at that point.
Totally. Because if you think about it, it's the most sort of self-effacing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not actually writing my own original work. I'm just taking these words of this man and translating them into English. The reason I'm a little bit reluctant to think about her as a translator is if you took a look at these Psalms that she translated, she used the most amazing poetic forms. She varied every poem is, sorry, I said every poem, every Psalm is a different, almost every Psalm is a different form of poetry. So we have sonnets, we have terza rima, we have, you know, I mean, it's just someone I read called it like a compendium of English verse. If you just didn't know anything about English poetry, you could just read her Psalms and see the variety. And then she did write several beautiful long poems, including one to Queen Elizabeth. And she also wrote a short play, a dialogue for Queen Elizabeth. So she, you know, and she translated some poems of Petrarch, and she translated a beautiful French tragedy. So, you know, she varied things. But I do think it's, as you say, not, it's by no means a coincidence. And many women writers during the period began their careers as translators.
But I love, as you mentioned, those subtle changes that they make. And you know, you can get so much from that, I think. So what about Amelia Lanyard? You mentioned her. So what drew you to her story? What makes her fascinating?
So she's the most surprising figure, as I said, because she's the daughter of a recorder player at the court of Elizabeth. Her father, Baptista Bassano, was born in Venice, and he and his brothers came over from Venice to create a little recorder consort, a recorder ensemble for Henry VIII. So on our talking Tudors theme, these are Tudor musicians who stayed with the Tudor family. They managed to stay in position through, you know, Henry, Edward, Mary, and Elizabeth. And there's some evidence that her father was Princess Elizabeth, when she was princess's Italian and lute teacher. It's not 100% confirmed, but there are correspondences in Italian. There are letters that the father wrote to Queen Elizabeth, which I find very, very touching. So Amelia Lanyard grew up, you know, with this, you know, very sort of middle-class father who was a musician, and all of her uncles were musicians and cousins. And her father died when she was 5. She had a much older sister who was married. So she lived alone with her mother, who was an English woman who seems to be, as I mentioned, illiterate. So the big question is, how did she go from that background to being someone who claims that she dreamt in Latin? Okay, so I should mention that women weren't even supposed to learn Latin. Latin was for boys. She certainly knew her Latin. So there are lots of questions about her. And one of the really fascinating sources about Amelia Lanyard is the astrologer whom she saw for a number of consultations in 1597. It was very popular in this period to consult an astrologer. This astrologer in particular, Simon Forman, was also, we would call him basically a quack because he didn't have an actual medical education, but he was also a medical practitioner. So Elizabeth Lanyard went to consult with him because she was afraid she was having a miscarriage. And she did, in fact, miscarry. And that was something that unfortunately happened to her a number of times. She was able to have one child, but she had one child before her marriage, which we can come back to, but one child with her husband who died as an infant, and then multiple miscarriages. Anyway, when she went to see this clinician / astrologer, he was a great keeper of records. So we have his, we call them case books. We have his case books where, I wish I could show you, Natalie, a page, but you literally see him drawing her astrological chart. And it says on the top, Amelia Lanyard, age 29, you know, and he draws out the chart and then he puts notes underneath. So much of what we know about her personal life, we're reading through his notes about her. So just as when we today go see a doctor for the first time and they ask us our medical history and they ask us questions about ourselves, he seems to have asked all those questions. So that's how we gain a lot of what we know. Based on that information, what she told him was that she was taken up by the Countess of Kent. So what does this mean? If this is true, and it probably is because we have to explain somehow, it means that through some set of connections, maybe through her father's connections at court, maybe her mother knew someone through her Protestant circles. The Countess of Kent more or less adopted Amelia Lane, or I should say took her up as a ward in her household. And she says that she was brought up, that's the expression she uses, she was brought up by the Countess of Kent. So something lucky happened. And that's the kind of, you know, thing that happens to so many of these people. Someone maybe identified a talent in her. Someone thought this girl can't grow up with an illiterate mother. Or maybe the mother said to some set of friends, I'd like to find some way for this daughter of mine who's brilliant to get an education. But I'm making things up right now. What we don't know is how she got there and what happened when she was there. All we know is that, you know, by the time she was in her very early 30s, that's when we have the first traces. She started to write extraordinary poetry. There might have been poems before that, but she started to write extraordinary poetry. And one of the earliest poems that we have, which she wrote, is actually a poem to the fourth woman in my book, to Anne Clifford and her mother. So that's one of these nice links. It seems she was more or less hired in 1604 to live with Anne Clifford and her mother, Margaret, as a companion for Anne, as a tutor. She might've been teaching her Italian or music. We don't know what she was doing, but she lived with them at a country house from Margaret's family called Cookham. And Amelia Lehner wrote this beautiful poem called An Ode to Cookham, which turns out now we know to be the first country house poem ever written in the English language. That's a very specific genre that, you know, not everybody knows about, but it's a category of poems that you write to a home, to a house. And it was an ancient genre. So we have poems from Horace and Martial. When I was in college, Natalie, and studying Renaissance literature, I read this beautiful poem by Ben Jonson called To Penshurst. And that was considered the first country house poem. And that was to the Sydney estate, Penshurst, where Mary Sydney partially grew up and where her brother, in which her brother inherited. Anyway, I find it quite moving that we now have evidence that a woman's poem preceded that and the house was run by another woman. So we have this little female utopia at Cookham, which Amelia Lehner recorded.
Oh, I love that. I love the network. I love it all. And I have to say, I was quite embarrassed when I had a look at the women you featured that I'd never heard of her. I just felt awful and terrible. The others, yes, of course, but she's the one that I kind of went, wait a second, who is this woman and why don't I know her?
Yes, it's funny. A couple of days ago, a review of my book, a beautiful review came out in the New York Times by Tina Brown. And she said, you know, my heart breaks for Amelia Lehner. Oh. I mean, that she just felt the pathos of this woman. And I should say what Tina Brown is responding to and what I haven't said is, you know, in 1611, she published this extraordinary book of poems called Salve Deus Rex Judiorum with a very intimidating Latin title, which means Hail Christ, King of the Jews. But the book of poems is a really, you know, the most proto-feminist book of poems we could ever imagine. It's dedicated to 9 women. She says she wants only women readers. And in addition to the poem I just described to Cookham, there's a very long central poem called Salve Deus in which she excuses or exculpates Eve for the fall on the basis that Eve was just ignorant and didn't know what she was doing with the apple, whereas Adam did. But the bulk of it is to blame men for the crucifixion of Christ and to say, all bets are off. She puts in the mouth of Pontius Pilate's wife, you know, this long, passionate tirade against men for killing Christ. And Pontius, in the Bible, Pontius Pilate's wife, you know, tells her husband not to go forward with the crucifixion, that she's had a dream. And Amelia Lehner takes that tiny, tiny moment, it's only in the Gospel of Matthew, and she turns it into this long, long, passionate speech in which this woman without even a name in the Bible says, if you guys do this, then we should now be equal again. That this sort of levels us off, that women and men deserve to be equal. So, you know, this book of poetry is just a bomb. But I'm getting to the point about feeling sorry for her. Published in 1611. That's it. There's no second edition. It was actually published twice within a year, probably because a printer changed, but was never republished. She went on to have financial troubles and do all sorts of entrepreneurial things. She never wrote anything that has survived after that. And it wasn't until the late 20th century that she was recovered.
Goodness, what a story. Well, I'm so delighted that you've, you know, brought her to my attention and to the attention that everyone that's yes. reading your book. That's extraordinary. So let's talk a little bit about Elizabeth Carey now. So I read that she published the first original play by a woman. So do you want to tell us a little bit about her life and work?
Yeah. So I keep changing who my favorite woman is in this book. For a long time, she was my favorite. Elizabeth Carey was a girl genius. By the time she was five, apparently, she had learned Latin, French, Italian, Spanish, and picked up whatever language her Transylvanian house guest was speaking. It might have been Romanian, it might have been, but anyway, apparently was communicating with this family friend from Transylvania. So we have someone who we would call a prodigy, probably. Her father, to his credit, recognized this great gift and was giving her lots of things to read. One of the great anecdotes about her is that he gave her Calvin when she was, I think, like 10. Calvin. Okay. And she read all of it and disagreed and made a list of all the things she disagreed with. And that's interesting because later in her life, she actually converted to Catholicism. So remember, England was adamantly Protestant at this period. She was born in 1585. But in any case, she was a very, very brainy girl. She's the one who was reading all night long with the candles burning. And yet, when she was a teenager, she got married off, I think she was 17, to a more or less penniless nobleman. So here we have a classic sort of everyone was gaining something except for her. Her father wanted his daughter Elizabeth to marry into the aristocracy with the hope that he would eventually get a title. Would become a gentleman even. So that means literally to have a sir in front of his name. He was ambitious socially. The husband needed money. So a match was made. She was not consulted. And there's no recognition of her talents or her gifts. You know, she's just sold off like cattle because she has money. Our main source for her, I said that, you know, for each of these women, we have different sources. For Mary Sidney, because she had secretaries and had, you know, we have letters, we have much more documentation. For Amelia Lanier, we mostly, in terms of her personal life, have the records of her therapist slash astrologer, who, by the way, either tried to sleep with her or almost slept with her or sexually harassed her. There's a whole story there about what happened between them sexually, which is a separate topic. In the case of Elizabeth Carey, we have a magnificent biography written by her four daughters. In this case, after her death, four of her children decided that their mother's life was worth remembering. And they together wrote, and I say together because there's signs, the scholar who published it recently, Heather Wolf, has done amazing work on the manuscript and sort of sees different hands writing different notes. So we don't know, you know, who exactly wrote more or less, but she had four daughters who had all become Catholic nuns. She tried to convert all of her children and was successful with most of them. And they had become Catholic nuns in France. And around 6 years after her death, they completed this memoir. And so we have lots and lots of details. And what's touching is that, where did they hear all of this? How did they hear about her childhood? How did they hear about her reading cabinet? It must have come from her. So the way we sometimes now might record our grandparents or, you know, ask lots of questions about our older parents or relatives so that we can remember them, something similar must have happened here. And they tell her story. So everything is, we always have to think as historians, as readers, where are we getting this information from? So, you know, with Amelia Lanier, it's a suspicious source because this guy had various intentions with her. And so can we believe everything? With Elizabeth Carey, it's her daughters who loved her and a little bit are making her into a saint-like figure in the biography. But they say that her father never cared for her mother. They say because she was not very pretty. This is what they say. And she was nothing fair, I think they say. And she was very, very low, they say, meaning very short and very fat at some point. So she became fat. The poor woman had to bear this husband who, you know, made her ride horses when she hated riding horses, who made her, you know, get dressed up all the time because he was a courtier. She wanted to stay at home. There's a very funny anecdote of her maids chasing her around her room with a hairbrush because she just probably wanted to be reading Seneca or whatever she was doing. So this was a very problematic marriage. And yet it produced 12 children. So, you know, she was also being very active, both sexually and as a mother. She nursed her own children, which was extremely unusual for women of her class. Most women had wet nurses. So she was either nursing or pregnant for around 15 years. How did this woman manage to write anything? So the play that you refer to, The Tragedy of Marian, which is really her best known work and her masterpiece, was written, we think, before the children were born. She might have been pregnant with her oldest daughter, Catherine. It was written around 1609. I say around because we don't know exactly when it was written. There's sort of internal ways to date it, but it was published in 1613. And the play itself, a little bit like Amelia Lander, we could call a feminist play or a proto-feminist play. It tells the story of an ancient Jewish princess, Miriam, who refuses to obey her husband, who's a tyrant, and she refuses to sleep with him. She says she won't share his bed, and she refuses to give him really what he wants in any way, which leads to her being murdered. She's falsely accused of adultery by him through his wicked sister. So I like to think of this play, Natalie, as a kind of rethinking of Othello. We know that Elizabeth Carey, her daughters tell us she loved to go to plays. She loved to go to the theater. And she would have had the chance to see Othello. She certainly could have known about Othello. But instead of Desdemona's quiet, sweet accepting of her fate and preparing to die, sort of self-sacrifice, we have this just straight-talking, you know, strong, stubborn woman who stands by her conscience and makes her husband suffer. It also ends in tragedy. So that's, you know, that was her fate. But that was her best known work. After that, she wrote a number of things that, or over the course of her life, a number of works that unfortunately are lost. Maybe one day we'll find them. But her daughters describe the things that remain. There's a quite fascinating history of the King Edward II, who was also the subject of a Christopher Marlowe play. There again, we see she emphasizes the woman's story, the wife of Edward II. Edward II was homosexual and didn't care for his wife, Isabella, who suffered a lot. And Elizabeth pours herself into that. And I also think it must have been partially writing from her own experience because her husband apparently didn't really care for her. So we have that, and then we have some religious works that she translated.
How wonderful to have that memoir or the recollections of her children. Like so often, you know, these women in history, we've got almost nothing, and it's just amazing that this survives.
It's amazing work, and it was rediscovered. It was written in the 1640s. It was rediscovered in the 19th century in the archives in France from the nunnery, and so someone found it and published it as a Catholic life, basically.
Oh, I live in hope that we'll find other things in the future because I love those stories of things resurfacing. Yeah. So there's one more woman that you feature, and you've already mentioned her, of course, Anne Clifford, the diarist. So do you want to tell us a little bit about her life? And she had also many challenges in her life.
She is the most fascinating character. You know, sometimes people ask you, you know, who would you like to have dinner with? Yeah. You know, I think she's my number one choice for dinner because she was just a ball of fire. So this woman was born in 1590 into the most extraordinary wealth and pedigree. So she makes Mary Sidney's family look kind of like nouveau riche because she dates her family back to the Norman Conquest and they owned 90,000 acres in the north of England. So, you know, they were, I think, maybe the largest landowners in England after the monarch. She was an only child. Her parents had a terrible marriage and actually more or less were divorced. They lived separately and her father sent what we would call alimony, basically, to the mother, although he often forgot to send it. But the most significant thing that happened to her and that shapes her life as a writer is that when her father died and she was 15, he disinherited her. So no, disinherit is too strong. But because he provided money, but her family's history was such that the entire estate was supposed to go to the direct heir, regardless of sex. So the Clifford family, he was the Earl of Cumberland, had a specific law that was passed in the 14th century. The king created what was called an entail, that all of the land. So think about, you know, Downton Abbey or all the Jane Austen novels we've all read, where, you know, the sisters are all sitting around thinking, who's going to inherit? That wasn't the case in the Clifford family. She was an only child, and there was a law that the property should go to the direct heir. Her father decided otherwise and disinherited her and left all his money to his brother. He, as I say, he provided cash, you know, to her, but he wanted the estate and the name to carry on because, of course, she would marry outside of the family. So that happened in 1605. And for the next almost 40 years, she fought that. She fought it with lawsuits. She fought it by defying her husband, by defying her king. This was just a fierce, strong woman who said she would do anything to get back her land. How do we know all of this? Because as you already mentioned, she kept a diary and she started a diary. Her earliest self-writing is from 1603, which is 2 years before her father died. She wrote some years after, probably in the early 1610, 11, she wrote, went back and wrote a memoir of the year 1603 because it was a particularly memorable year. Her diary starts with the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, with the death of Queen Elizabeth. And she was actually at the funeral and she describes that. And she describes the arrival of the new king and queen from Scotland and rushing, you know, sleeping on the floor of a castle overnight to get to the spot where they were going to welcome the new king and queen. She describes the plague in 1603 and being quarantined. When I read this, you know, after our pandemic, I really had the shivers. Her mother was so angry at her for riding in a carriage with someone who was sick, and they quarantined her for 10 days. So a lot of the protocol that we had. Anyway, she started by writing a memoir of 1603. And then within a decade, she was keeping a daily diary. And she basically kept a diary until the day before she died in 1676 at the age of 86. And her last sentence was, "Thank God I am so well." And then she died the next day. So she was someone who thought that her own life mattered, that her story mattered, and she wanted to keep track of it. And reading her diary, Natalie, is like entering into, you know, someone's inner life at the level, you know, she says things like, "Today, you know, I read Chaucer. I'm wearing my green taffeta. I ate too much cheese and my stomach feels sick. I'm angry at my lord," that's her husband, "because he took the child," her daughter, to his sister's house. You know, we get this weird combination of what she's thinking, how she's feeling, what she ate, what she's reading, who she's meeting, all mixed up together. But her primary motivation, I think, in keeping the diary was to keep track, not just to keep track, but was what I think Freud would say, to work through her lawsuit and her anguish about not being able to have what she thought was rightfully hers. And her biggest ally in this was her own mother, who, as I mentioned already, was separated from the father and was unbelievably angry. So, you know, a 15-year-old girl can't start a lawsuit. But as this is interesting, we talked earlier about what women couldn't do. So women were allowed to sue, which is interesting. So her guardian, her legal guardian, was her mother. And her mother started the lawsuit and hired a team of lawyers and archivists and so on. So what started as a combative project, I think, turned into a life project of writing. And her diary is really her companion. She's very lonely. At one point, she says, quoting a psalm, in fact, "I'm like an owl in the desert." You know, she was all alone. She says, "I'm very lonely. I'm very melancholic." She talks about her psychological state in ways that we so rarely get to see in women from this period. We don't get to hear that, you know? So reading her is extraordinary. And I do just want to mention that her diary, interestingly, fascinatingly, her earliest diaries were published in 1923, so 101 years ago, by Vita Sackville-West. So Vita Sackville-West was Anne Clifford's husband's direct relative. Her first husband was named Richard Sackville. And Vita Sackville-West came upon the manuscripts in the house where she grew up, where Anne Clifford lived with her husband, Noel House. And Vita decided to publish this extraordinary woman, this descendant of hers, who had given voice to so much that we don't know about from the period. So that was the first publication in 1923, but then it wasn't until the late 20th century that the other diaries started to be published. And only recently, thanks to the work of an amazing scholar, Jessica Millay, have all of her autobiographical writings been published. Because she also wrote, you know, a full memoir of her life with the great title, "The Life of Me," which I love. And she then compiled a family history that's, you know, three enormous books, like the size of the biggest atlas you've ever seen, called The Great Book of Records, that goes back to her Norman conqueror ancestors all the way up through herself.
How amazing. These women sound absolutely extraordinary. And to have her story in her own voice is so rare. You know, person I study is Anne Boleyn, and I could only dream about having that sort of,
Can you imagine? It is amazing.
It's absolutely incredible. So Raimi, in terms of insights, I can see you've obviously gotten a lot from this particular project and researching and studying these women. Insights into being a woman or being a woman writer, what are some of the ones that have really stuck with you?
Well, I would say my great astonishment really, and so in this sense, it does correspond to Virginia Woolf's basic thesis, is, you know, how many conditions have to have lined up for these women to be able to write. And, you know, I've been really struck by the fact that, for example, once Elizabeth Carey was burying all of those children, she couldn't write anymore. When Mary Sidney lost her husband, she stopped writing. And that's sort of bizarre, but, you know, she lost her sort of circle of support. So as a widow, there was at least a 15 or so year period where we don't have any trace of her writing. So, and, you know, Anne Clifford made a second marriage actually to the son of Mary Sidney. So this is another one of these. Mary Sidney was her mother-in-law, just in order to have the sort of infrastructure, to have the support of the husband in everything she was doing. So, you know, you really needed to navigate the system and work the system and have very often male support. Amelia Lehner, as I said, who was, you know, really take no prisoners, sort of early feminist. On the title page, it says Amelia Lehner, wife of Captain Alfonso Lehner. You know, it's like she identifies herself through her husband. So we have to keep in mind that these were very different times. And the idea of just being sort of on your own and writing, as Virginia Woolf says, is necessary, you know, was almost impossible to achieve. Virginia Woolf was right about that. But what I really feel, and this goes back to something I said at the beginning, is that, you know, what does it mean to have a gift, to have a vocation, to have something inside of you? You said you were a teacher. I've been a professor for 27 years now. And as you say, sometimes you can see that students just have that, you know, whatever situation they come from. And so I think we're looking at genuinely exceptional people whose culture and world didn't encourage this at all. And yet they managed to do it. So it's a story of terrific endurance and triumph, and also, you know, believing in oneself, which all of which was necessary for women in a way that men had to have a vocation. Men, you know, were entitled to write, you know, everyone was writing sonnets, and many of them were terrible poets, but they felt entitled to do that. So, you know, it took all that much more as a woman to get your voice out there.
Yes. And I'm curious, because you mentioned earlier that you obviously had a pool of, was it about seven women to choose from? So are there any others that you feel deserve more attention?
Yes. I mean, if there had been a fifth woman in the book, it would have been Lady Mary Roth, who was actually the niece of Mary Sidney. Right. She was Mary Sidney's brother, Robert Sidney's daughter. And Mary Sidney knew her. And she wrote a romance, you know, a sort of epic romance and a sonnet series in the early 17th century, and was a fascinating character. When I was laying this out, I realized there was so much overlap between their family stories that it felt almost repetitive, but she deserves our attention for sure. Another woman who I think is fascinating, who's sort of at the very end of this historical period, is Margaret Cavendish, who was a philosopher and a kind of scientist and a great writer. And there's actually, I'm glad I didn't include her in my book, because there's now a brilliant new biography of her by Francesca Peacock called Wit. So she's another very prominent figure. Then there are some more minor figures, a woman named Isabella Whitney, who I always say that, you know, Amelia Lehner was the first woman in the 17th century to publish a book of poems, because Isabella Whitney published a very small, but a book of poems in the 16th century. There's just not a lot of material about her. Someone could certainly dig it up. But I was also looking for women who were born, my four women were all born during, they could have been Shakespeare's sisters, basically, or anyway, were born during Shakespeare's lifetime. I was really thinking about the fact that many of us, when we have thought about what it would be like to be a woman in the period, think about Shakespeare's heroines. We think about Portia and Rosalind and, you know, Viola and Olivia. And these are fictional characters created by a man. And who are the real women behind these women? You know, so I tried to limit myself to women who were born roughly at the time of Shakespeare. So yeah, so Mary Roth, Margaret Cavendish, Isabella Whitney, as I say, is a little bit earlier and has sort of less of a strong footprint. And then, of course, someone that we have more of a sense of, Aphra Behn, who was, you know, also younger, but extraordinary. So these are some of the other names that if I were going to now double the book, I would I would want to pursue.
Maybe a part two. There has to be another part to it. So I have one final question for you, Raimi. You've been so generous with your time already. Sometimes there's this idea that women in this period were simply passive members, solely passive members of their communities. So why do you feel it's important to try and recover their voices and kind of refute this idea that they were just passive members of their communities?
I think that it's so important to see how half of the population was experiencing the world they were living in. You know, this is not some minor group of, you know, a cult that we found in, you know, some pocket of the world. And I think the same can be done for any period in history, right? That women have always been, by definition, roughly half of the people living. And we hear so little about them. So, you know, everything going on in England is refracted through the women in my book. I mean, you know, I have firsthand reports of the Spanish Armada, of the killing of King Charles, and so on, of all of the big events that were going on. We only hear about those things typically through the men. And it's not so much not only that they were active members of the public sphere, because really they weren't, they couldn't run for office. They couldn't be lawyers or doctors or architects, you know? So it's a quieter impact, but it's a real experience, you know, that these women were all living, breathing, sharing the worlds that the men we always hear about were living. And I think our picture of the Renaissance, I hope our picture of the Renaissance really changes when we think about what it was like to be married off against your will, to be stuck at home when your brothers are sent off to school, to have your sons go off to war, all of these things, which, you know, we know are happening, but we only know it from the other side. So I hope and I know that other women who are experts in other fields are all doing this kind of work right now, as are people from different ethnic and racial minorities. You know, let's get all the voices onto the table. Let's not only hear history from, you know, the male dominant perspective, which is also important, but to fill it out, we're really only hearing half of the story.
And I think you've given us so many things to think about, important questions, especially being Women's History Month. I think that's wonderful.
Yes,
for
exactly.
Us to reflect on those things. And the very last thing, and then I'll let you get on with your day, is the Tudor takeaway. So I ask all my guests for something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. So do you have a takeaway for us?
So yes, I saw that you asked me that. And in terms of things that I love about that have been done about Tudor history, for me, I think I want everyone to go watch Mark Rylance star in Wolf Hall. I think this is just the most brilliant capturing of not just, you know, those personalities and characters, it sounds like, which is your primary field, but also the interiors, the spaces, the fact that people live in these dark halls and carpets and the rugs. And so that's my sort of more serious recommendation would be, you know, anyone interested in Tudor history, if they haven't seen that British television series, Wolf Hall. And then the other thing as a woman historian is I want everyone to go see Six. I think Six is such a fun, irreverent, but also powerful way of thinking about, for your listeners who don't know it, this is a musical sort of the genre of Hamilton, an original, you know, musical about the six wives of Henry VIII, with just those women on stage telling their stories. And it just brings so much to life about something that we all say, oh, Henry VIII had all of these wives and he killed them off. But hearing them singing their hearts out, to me, is one of the great introductions, especially for my students, for my son and his generation. I think it's just a really interesting take on Tudor history.
Well, I love both your takeaways. I love Wolf Hall and I love Six the Musical. So thank you so much, okay. Raimi. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk Tudors with us.
Thank you, Natalie. It's been a pleasure. And thanks to all your listeners for being here.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.